listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Monday saw the closing session of the UN General Assembly's annual general debate. Among the presenters, the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Nicaragua, Denis Reynaldo Moncada Colindres. These were his remarks in their entirety.
Su Excelencia.
Your Excellency, Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations. Your Excellency, Maria Fernanda Espinosa Garcés, President of the General Assembly. Ladies and gentlemen, representatives of member states. Distinguished delegates. Receive a message of peace from the people of Nicaragua and from President Comandante Daniel Ortega and Vice President Rosario Murillo. 3 years after the adoption of the 2030 Agenda, we continue to bear witness to a world in crisis originated by savage capitalism, interference, and violations of international law and the sovereignty of our peoples, with the use of force, attempts at coup d'etat and destabilization that threaten the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals set forth in the 2030 Agenda. Nicaragua has resisted the attempts at a coup d'etat. Our country once again has won peace, fraternal coexistence, and the progressive return of normal daily life. The attempted coup d'etat we overcame in Nicaragua is a result of this interventionism. It has left us with serious damage and a serious aftermath, such as economic damage, death, destruction, and terrorism. Terrorism disguises peaceful protest with vicious killings of citizens, policemen, setting public and private property on fire, assaults, rape, extortion, torture, and cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment. In our region, Nicaragua is highly recognized as a factor for regional stability, peace, and security, with important positive indicators in economic, political, and social development, poverty reduction, gender equity, and citizen security. Nicaragua is a barrier against international organized crime, the maras, the gangs, terrorism, and drug trafficking activity, all state policies which we continue to develop. The government and the people of Nicaragua defend the principle of independence and sovereignty as established by the Charter of the United Nations. We therefore demand and insist on the cessation of any interventionist policy in violation of international law with interventionist actions in Nicaragua and against the fraternal peoples of our Americas and of the world. The government and the people of Nicaragua have worked in a sustained fashion to meet the objectives of the 2030 Agenda. Until April of this year, our country was experiencing sustained economic growth of approximately 4.7% per year. Our projects and our social and economic programs to eradicate general poverty at the national level achieved a reduction from 42.5% in 2009 to 24.9% in 2016. Extreme poverty went down from 14.6% in 2009 to 6.9% in 2016. Today, once again, we are facing the threat of the United States to curb the social, economic, and cultural development of our people. We denounce this intervention and interference with a bill in the U.S. Congress ordering international financial organizations to oppose the granting of loans to Nicaragua. For Nicaragua, to contribute to international peace means achieving a general and complete nuclear disarmament. This is why we have signed and ratified the first treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. We call on other countries to join us in ratifying this historic treaty. The government of the Republic of Nicaragua supports the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through dialogue and communication between the authorities on both sides. We welcome the rapprochement between the two Koreas and the holding of the third inter-Korean summit, as well as the joint declaration of September in Pyongyang that was agreed upon by the two Korean leaders and which is seen as a breakthrough to alleviate the tension on the peninsula and to substantially eliminate the danger of war in the entire peninsula. The government of the Republic of Nicaragua hopes that nuclear weapons will be dismantled in a complete, verifiable, and irreversible manner, and that the countries involved will cooperate and in this way ensure a firm and lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. The government of Nicaragua supports the nuclear negotiations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the E3 EU plus 3, which led to the completion of the Joint Action Plan, or JCPOA, on July 14, 2015. We emphasize that this agreement demonstrates that dialogue and diplomacy are the most appropriate means to solve these problems as an essential part of making multilateralism work. Nicaragua condemns the criminal blockade of our sister Republic of Cuba and all its extraterritorial measures and ramifications. Nicaragua rejects any coercive economic measure to try to break the will and spirit of freedom of and sovereignty of peoples and governments. For our country, the use of unilateral coercive economic measures is unacceptable as a selective political instrument to illegally change governments. This year, once again, we will vote against the unjust blockade. Our sister Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, its Bolivarian people, and the legitimate government of President Nicolas Maduro have our full solidarity. We have condemned the attempt to assassinate President Nicolas Maduro and the threat of military intervention against the people and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. We must continue supporting decolonization in the world. We must support the Palestinian, Sahrawi, Puerto Rican peoples and the Malvinas Islands of Argentina. Nicaragua advocates the creation of the two states, the State of Israel and the State of Palestine, with East Jerusalem as its capital, within the borders of 1967, living together in peace and harmony. We reiterate our complete solidarity with the government and the people of Syria in their fight against international terrorism and in the defense of their sovereignty and territorial integrity. Humanity continues to clamor for peace. Yet even after 73 years, our organization has not managed to fully comply with the objectives set for peace. Given this deplorable situation, the call for the reinvention of the United Nations is urgent, as proposed by the Nicaraguan foreign minister and priest, Miguel Descoto, during his presidency of this General Assembly. To achieve this, we must bring about the unavoidable, sorely needed change for this organization to serve the interests of all its members and humanity as a whole. We wish to stress that while holding the presidency of this General Assembly in 2008, Father Miguel Descoto, may he rest in peace, who we rightfully call the Foreign Minister of Dignity of Nicaragua, developed precisely these ideas and fought for them until the end, fulfilling the mandate of Nicaragua to lay the foundation for the discussion of these transformations with his proposal document, The Reinvention of the United Nations. We need urgent action to combat climate change. The principle of common but differentiated responsibility remains in force, and the major sources of emissions and those responsible for degradation, and natural imbalances must recognize our losses and damage and contribute to the recovery of life on Mother Earth and of the peoples of the world. To achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, we need to strike down the unilateral coercive measures that violate international law and block the development plans of our countries. We must work for justice, peace, respect, dialogue, and sovereign security in the world. In order to do this, we must promote the indispensable transformation for this organization to serve the interests of all its members. Our government and our people advocate a world with values, where human beings can count on the best of themselves, the best of ourselves, to foster the best possible conditions for fair, sustainable, equitable, secure, and sovereign development. and for progress in science and technology reflected in all areas of our lives to be accessible and shared by all. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, we bring the greetings and the hope of the Nicaraguan people that at this 73rd session, the commitment that we make will result in an open, far-reaching process of reflection towards the mandatory transformation for the reinvention and democratization of the United Nations. President, to conclude, we affirm our commitment to continue fighting for peace, which is a priority for our world, for our peoples. We reaffirm that the conflicts that arise in different regions of our planet can be overcome through dialogue, through negotiation, and above all, free from the use or threat of the use of force. This is what all of our peoples long for, from the peoples of the great powers to small states that may be small in population, that may be small in development, but that are great in their values and history. Thank you very much.
So that was the foreign minister of Nicaragua on Monday at the UN General Assembly's general debate. Another person from the region piling on Washington, as we heard last week, Cuba's president, Bolivia's president, Venezuela's president were, to be kind, critical of Washington. And even Mexico's president, the outgoing Enrique Peña Nieto, was calling for an end to the U.S. blockade against Cuba, among other things. Nicaragua, of course, having just experienced the attempted coup, there's no other way of putting it, really, that began in April of this year, and things are now back to normal. So we have an update of other stuff in the region and a little pile-on from locally in Nicaragua. Our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, welcome.
Thanks, Don. I haven't had time to listen to what Foreign Minister Moncada had to say in his speech, but I assume from the headlines that I've read that he's just demanding that the United States stop its endless interference in Nicaragua's internal affairs. That's in particularly relevant in relation to the fact that last week, I think some Senate commission approved the NECA Act approved that it should go to wherever it was headed to. Is it the House of Representatives or the Senate? I think it's headed to the plenary of the Senate, isn't it?
You're talking about the U.S. Senate. So, moving forward. I mean, we've had this thing, you know, it's been sort of floating around in the bowels of the U.S. Congress for a couple of years. It was an initiative under the Obama administration, and Trump apparently, if the rhetoric that comes out of Nikki Haley's mouth or Bolton, of course, with his whole history, is any indication, then they intend to continue that to the disappointment of many.
Yeah, well, and for here in Nicaragua, and the people have been kind of looking at what that might mean for the Nicaraguan economy, and in specific terms, what the provisions of the NECA Act lay out are that the United States government will vote against any loans for Nicaragua in multilateral international financial organizations like the World Bank, like the International Monetary Fund, and possibly a couple of other institutions of which I'm not fully aware. But and that is unlikely to affect Nicaragua's investment program until at the earliest 2020, and maybe not even then, because Nicaragua has already negotiated a bunch of loans that have been approved And the United States can't kind of retroactively undo that approval that those loans have received. So Nicaragua has very, very good standing with the World Bank, with the International Monetary Fund, and with the Inter-American Bank, for example, which is a subsidiary of the World Bank, because it's so efficient in the administration of those funds. It's regarded as one of the most efficient administrators of those institutions' loans in the whole world, or certainly, obviously we're only talking about Latin America, but certainly in Latin America. And so the immediate effect over the next year, year and a half on Nicaragua's public investment program will be zero. Right. So the question then is, well, what other measures will the United States bring in order to attack Nicaragua's economy,
right,
just as they have done in Venezuela, with the idea of reversing popular opinion in Nicaragua, which, despite all the false coverage in North American and European media, is still overwhelmingly supportive of President Daniel Ortega and his government.
Right. And you know what's interesting to me? When I see this kind of stuff happening, I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's great. I guess somebody's trying to help kickstart the Nicaraguan canal project, because if they're going to start beating up on Nicaragua's economy, how far behind can a rescue package from China be?
That's an open question, and I think I've remarked to you in the past that my view is that the reason that the canal is in suspension, the start of work on Nicaragua's interoceanic canal has been suspended temporarily, by all accounts, is because over the next year or two, China wants to see exactly how its relations develop with the United States, because it's not going to invest tens of billions of dollars of its money in building a canal that is just going to be occupied militarily by the United States. I think that's the fundamental reservation which is preventing the immediate start of work on the canal, along with the fact that, as President Ortega has noted, they're still trying to fine-tune the environmental mitigation effects that they have to implement in order to meet the very high standards laid out in the consultant's environmental and social impact report.
Right, that's right.
There's a company called ERM based in London that's supposed to be the world leader in that kind of evaluation and appraisal, and they set very stringent environmental conditions to be satisfied before they think the canal should go ahead, and they think the canal is viable if those conditions are met.
Right. I mean, you have on the one hand these folks that are saying you're rushing to judgment, you're going to destroy the environment. The state says, no, we're not. We're taking our time, and we're going to work these problems and have them under control before we go ahead. So that's what ends up happening. And the same people that said you're rushing it are saying, what happened? You're taking too long. I'm looking at an announcement. So then, there's an announcement.
The nitty-gritty, the fundamental of that in terms of Nicaragua's economy is that, despite their efforts to destroy the economy, because what the United States set out to do from the start, when it set in motion this attempted coup, they actually started work on that back in probably 2015, but it wasn't until 2017, and actually 2016 in relation to the NECA Act. With what they were doing with the NECA Act was saying to Nicaragua's business class, which had previously been an alliance, a very successful alliance, with the government and with the labor sector in Nicaragua, with the NECA Act and other associated measures and policy statements that they made from 2015 onwards, they were saying to the Nicaraguan business class, well, you either stop working with the government, or we're going to hit you with stuff like measures under the Magnitsky Act, for example. which is used to target business people and other people, other public figures in countries that are targeted by the United States. So, and what the business class did at that point was they divided. Right. And some of them, a minority, remained in working with the government. And but the major part of the Nicaragua's business sector decided to work in cahoots with the opposition. And they were the ones that tried to impose the kind of economic damage on the economy that they thought would bring the government to its knees and convince them, convince President Ortega to resign. How wrong can they be?
Right.
You know, and they completely failed in that. And now they are blaming the government for the economic damage that they caused.
Right. You know, there's something else, too, as far as that goes. This is not just a project of the, you know, some Republican gusanos in Florida, although certainly it is that. You have Ileana Ross Layton in from Miami, for example, and formerly of some upper income neighborhood of Cuba before the revolution, as a sponsor in the House, and it passed the House last year, by the way. And you have, though, in the Senate, for example, not just Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who you would expect, and Bob Menendez, who's a Democrat, but who you'd also expect, but even Patrick Leahy and Dick Durbin, who introduced their own bill. Well, Durbin and Shelley Capito introduced their own bill last year, but Durbin and Leahy support this as well. They're looking, in other words, the things you're talking about, starving Nicaragua economically. This is just fine with the, you know, but Pat Leahy from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, you know, a buddy from Vermont.
Yeah, and let's see how they get on. And it's clearly a bipartisan policy at this point.
Yep.
Because, why? Because the elites in the United States recognize that unless they crush governments that pose a threat in all kinds of ways, but in Nicaragua's case, precisely because of its economic success, it makes U.S. policy in the rest of the region look stupid.
Right.
And just look at Argentina.
Right.
So obviously that's why they want to squash Nicaragua, and so they've got a couple of years before the elections in 2021. That's the crucial date for them.
Right, that's the time.
So they need to turn opinion in Nicaragua around before November 2021, when the next presidential elections happen.
Right.
Will they be able to do it? Well, we'll see.
Right. And just we've got about 4.5 minutes, so I want to jump into some of the other things, but just the last note is that in terms of China also, by the way, not just direct relations with the United States would they be keeping an eye on, but watching how all of this tug of war between the people of the region and the United States, you know, how that plays out, because China isn't just worried about a military occupation by the United States of a canal that they'd build, but also one by banks or lenders, because it turned out that they weren't allowed to trade with anyone in the hemisphere, and therefore the value of the canal, you know, substantially tanks. And so we'll have to watch that. But and what I'd like to make sure we talk about the judgment of the ICJ with Bolivia and Chile for sure, and also President Maduro in Venezuela and whatever else we can squeeze in.
Well, and the judgment that just came out of just a few hours ago in the International Court of Justice, very disappointing for Bolivia. It remains to be seen what effect that will have on public sentiment in support of Evo Morales in Bolivia, because he pinned his prestige, his personal prestige as Bolivia's president, on getting a successful judgment from the International Court of Justice overturning Chile's refusal to negotiate a sovereign access for Bolivia to the Pacific Ocean. So we'll see what happens about that. And it is a huge disappointment for Bolivia, but there are other cases pending, which the International Court of Justice has a record of trying to balance out judgment, one judgment against another. So while they've judged in favor of Chile this time round, there are still two or three cases pending between Bolivia and Chile in which they're likely to favor Bolivia. And that would be my prediction, but we'll see. And it was very interesting to see that Evo Morales in the Security Council, in the same session in which Donald Trump was chairing for the United States, Evo Morales was acerbic in his criticisms of the United States to the face of Donald Trump.
He was, he was.
And so, you know, I mean, that won't endear him to the U.S. government, and nor will Nicolas Maduro's remarks in the U.N.
Right.
When he made his speech, and also Díaz-Canel, Miguel Díaz-Canel, the Cuban president. But the hallmark of all those leaders, Evo Morales, Nicolas Maduro, Miguel Díaz-Canel, Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua, is their absolute conviction that the only way to resolve differences is via dialogue and not via intimidation.
Right.
And Daniel, in a speech on Saturday to a huge crowd of people, completely contradicting the ridiculous reports that the Nicaraguan government doesn't have popular support. He was speaking to a huge crowd of people in the rain on Saturday. It reminded me very much of Hugo Chavez's last election address before he died, when that famous occasion when he spoke to thousands, tens of thousands of people in the rain. And Daniel was talking to people, and he was saying, look, the United States needs to understand that if they try and intimidate us, all they do is firm up our resolve.
That's right. That's what happened. And, you know, I was listening with bated breath, really, for a reference to the scent of sulfur at the General Assembly when he spoke. He did not invoke that. And I guess we're kind of out of time. Next week we can pick up. And we'd like to discuss what's happening in Colombia. Next week's elections in Brazil. Well, that snuck up on us. The national strike in Costa Rica and a lot of other stuff. So thank you very much for your time, Tony, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome to Sophie and Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The Afghan war against the Taliban has dragged on for 17 years, but the terror group shows no signs of defeat. What are Afghanistan's chances to finally end the bloodshed? We'll ask Afghan Deputy Foreign Minister Nasir Andisha.
The war against the Taliban has been bogged down and stalemate for 17 years now, and almost half of all Afghans have grown up knowing only conflict, without any prospect of peace. Is Afghanistan doomed to be dealing with an insurgency forever? Can any government in Kabul persuade the guerrillas to sit down and negotiate? And when will the war-torn country finally begin to start healing its wounds?
Deputy Foreign Minister Nasir Andisha, thank you very much for being part of this show today. Great pleasure.
My pleasure too.
Afghanistan is always such a hot topic of discussion. So the latest version of Afghan war that has been going on for 17 years doesn't seem like anyone is close to claiming victory. How long do you think this stalemate will last?
You see, there is an effort to get rid of what has been termed as a stalemate militarily, and that is an approach toward peace and reconciliation in one hand. But then on the other hand, you know, our fight has to continue with irreconcilable elements, because in this war, in this fight, we have real serious terrorist groups whose aim and its goal has not changed ever since. So they are there for the destruction of the Afghan community, Afghan way of life, but also they are threatening region. So while, you know, we should focus on peace and reconciliation to bring stability in Afghanistan, we should also keep in mind that with the groups whose interest and whose goal is to spread terrorism and extremism in the region, we need to fight. And that will continue as long as we get rid of them.
All of Afghan leaders, past, present, have told me the same thing, that this war needs to be negotiated till the very end. Is there a reliable Taliban leadership that could actually negotiate with?
I think this has been one of the difficulties of the Taliban's address and the leadership, because the leadership is outside the country. We have these shuras in Quetta and Peshawar. So to reach them and to find them has been a difficulty. You know, in the past we had groups who were pro-peace, but then also we had groups who were against peace. But right now, there is an address, which is in Qatar, and there is a political office of Taliban with whom or to whom we are talking. But then, of course, there are elements within Afghanistan that they have a different approach to it. At least the address that we have right now, we are trying to reach peace with them.
What kind of a settlement is realistic right now? What kind of concessions to the Taliban in a post-war settlement do you think are feasible?
You see, that is something that it needs to be left for negotiations, because we are not at that stage. We are right now at the stage of facilitation. So we are
asking. You should have your best case scenario. I'm sure you have it.
You see, probably my best case scenario will be of my own view. But, you know, any settlement needs, the name is settlement. It means that, you know, there has to be compromises. The two sides has to accept the best solution, a compromise solution. But one thing which is very clear, and I think that has been made clear again and again by our leadership and also by the international community who is helping us, you know, including the Russian Federation, the leadership that we spoke with, is that state in Afghanistan is something very important, something very precious. And the problem has been in the past 40 years that every time there's a change, it's a state which has changed. It's, you know, a state which collapses. So if we keep the structure of the state, whatever happened within the structure of a state in terms of the governance and the way of governance and, you know, how much accountability and responsibility and concentration of power or decentralization of power and delegation of power, I think this is something that we can negotiate and discuss. But the overall structure of the state, which we have, you know, put forward, like, you know, in the since 2001, I think that has to be kept intact, which means that we should not go from a republic, which where people will decide, toward an emirate, where few clergy will decide. I think that is the overall, you know, framework that we are thinking about. Within this framework, I think there are many things for negotiations, and that's how a settlement should look like.
So when it came to Obama administration, it was very ambiguous about talks with Taliban, in a way initiating processes, but then being really tough militarily on Taliban on the field. The current administration is actually more favorable, accepting of the idea of talks. So do you think these are just empty words, or are they going to follow up on them?
You see, even in the past, in 2011, when there was a surge of the NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan, I think the surge was a mean to an end. The end was peace, but the mean was just to bring the Taliban into negotiating table, you know, to exert enough military and security pressure on the Taliban, which is, you know, happened everywhere in the world. We have, you know, had experience of this in Vietnam and everywhere else, that that the military leaders believe that, you know, to bring this insurgent, you know, sometimes the terrorist groups, onto negotiating table, you have to show resolve. I think that even the aim of the surge at the time was showing this result for the peace. But the problem was with the dates, because, you know, if you announce that, look, you know, I'm exerting this much pressure and this much span of time, of course, those terrorists will not fight you. They will hide. So for the time to come to an end. And this is, I think, one of the reasons, one of the difficulties that surge had. So they announced that the end date, we start in 2010 and we finish in 2011. The Taliban said, okay, fine, we'll go for hour and hour. Just they went out to Pakistan and they even didn't fight the Americans. And when the time over, they came back. Right now, it's different. It's not only a question of only talk. You know, the South Asia strategy of the United States is, it's called South Asia. It's not only for Afghanistan, because they also recognize that the sanctuaries, that the bases of Taliban, the base of Al-Qaeda, and the other foreign fighters, we should not forget that bin Laden was not from Abbottabad, are in Pakistan. So I think it's sort of, you know, pressure, both on Pakistan and on Taliban, but at the same time, a real offer of peace.
We're getting to Pakistan because there's a lot to discuss, this change in power. But there is also change in creative diplomacy in America. So when America says we're ready to talk to Afghan Taliban directly, Afghan Taliban is also saying we don't want to talk to the Afghan government. We're ready to talk to Washington directly. What happens if you are left out of the process? Because that's a possibility.
I think that shouldn't be even a possibility coming in the minds of anyone, neither in the region nor in the United States. Because we, at least in the past 4 years, we had very negative experiences of when you leave the government, the central government of a country, the legitimate government, behind, and you go and talk behind their back, which has not happened, and we are not going to let this happen in any case. So I think the tactics of these terrorist groups and insurgent groups always the same. We had this during the 80s, where our Mujahideen wanted to talk directly to Moscow at the time. And we saw the result of it, that it was a complete collapse of the system in Kabul. So they want to show that, look, we are going to talk to the Americans, but I think this is what the consensus is, that peace in Afghanistan has to be Afghan-owned, Afghan-led, and through direct talk between the Afghans themselves. The others can facilitate.
And maybe many would argue that Taliban and Afghans too. Mm-hmm. Taliban or Afghans.
So that's what I'm saying, that between Afghans, between us and the Taliban. So that should be the peace. Mediation, facilitation always happens in all the pieces around the world. You need somebody, at the level of confidence building and the level of guarantees, because even they want some guarantee that would this agreement will be fulfilled, implemented. We understand this, whoever they agree to guarantee the peace agreements or to facilitate, why we're in Moscow, because this is one of the venues where we have a forum, a regional forum called the Moscow Forum. Beside the others, the QCG, which is United States and China. We have a Heart of Asia, which happens in Turkey, Istanbul. So we have multiple forums where could guarantee and also could facilitate and mediate. So anything behind the Afghan government will be counterproductive.
So you've mentioned Pakistan a couple of times in the interview, and many Afghan officials that I have spoken in the past mostly blame Pakistan for the mess that Afghanistan is in. Pakistan now has a new prime minister, Imran Khan. He seems to be more progressive, very popular with the people. Do you think anything will change with him in power?
We are hoping so. We really hope that, with Imran Khan in power, things could change. And also, theoretically, whenever you have a change of leadership in a country, there is a window of opportunity to change policies. So we are keenly looking forward to see some of real strategic changes within Pakistan's approach, within Pakistan's mindset vis-a-vis Afghanistan and peace in Afghanistan. And their, broader approach toward the region, India or, Iran or Saudi Arabia or whatever, which has been in Pakistan for many years. So if we see a sign of change, which we have not so far, because we understand that probably Imran Khan has some other priorities, he's busy, going to Saudi Arabia and other places, but we are hopeful, we are expecting that, even for him, it will be good that if he could do something, which his predecessors could not do that. We had the foreign minister, Qureshi, who came to Kabul. We haven't heard something new, because we have a record of all what we have heard in the past 17 years. It's just right there with us. So I think the time of rhetoric is over between, the two countries when it comes to their relationship. We are very optimistic. We think that, he can take out of the box. He's a new person. He's not part of those same political parties which has been in the power in the past, in the past couple of decades that we are working with Pakistan. So somebody new, somebody close to military, which is another probably advantage if he could use it properly. So we think that could be helpful.
Dr. Andisha, we're going to take a short break right now. When we come back, we'll continue talking to Afghanistan's Deputy Foreign Minister, Nasir Andisha, talking about the prospects of peace in his country, Afghanistan. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Afghanistan's Deputy Foreign Minister, Nasir Andisha. Dr. Andisha, for Pakistan, Afghanistan has always been a tool of rivalry with India. And now Imran Khan is trying to cool down its relations with India. So maybe that could be a big change.
But you see, that on that, we really wish him the best. It's a very difficult thing, because I think this, to some people, Pakistan is, it defines the whole idea of Pakistan. You know, this country is created based on this ideology of, you know, fighting against India or being against it. But whatever Afghanistan could do on that, you know, I remember in 2007 and 5 when we were much more peaceful than today, even we offered that, can we do something for Pakistan and India could come together, closer with each other. In our side, we have done everything possible to, for the both countries, to tell them, look, Afghanistan is not a place of rivalry, it's a place of cooperation. If you countries could cooperate with each other, billions of dollars out of trade will be benefit for both of them, because if Indian goods and services and, you know, and Indian technology could get through Pakistan and Afghanistan, come to Russia and go to Europe, I think everybody will benefit. You know, somehow, this idea of trade liberalism doesn't work in that part of the world, so we hope one day it will.
But you know how those big powers are, especially the nuclear powers. He's trying to stabilize his relations with India now, hopefully it works, but U.S.-Pakistani relations have soured. Do you think there's a danger that they actually may mess with the Americans by giving more support to Taliban?
Well, you see, that I think that's something that they have to understand. I'm sure they do. You know, Pakistan has a strong establishment, you know, its military, its political leaders. They should probably know the limits of going toward Taliban and antagonizing United States. So I think the whole idea of South Asia policy of United States is to convince the Pakistanis that whatever interest you might seek in supporting Taliban is not feasible, is not desirable for the future of this country, which is called Pakistan. It's a huge nation. It's a vibrant society. It's a country which could be, you know, as prosperous as any other countries. It was going in the same speed as South Korea in the 1970s, but now it's lagging behind. It's one of the poorest. So we hope that, you know, when it comes to decisions, Pakistan should take the side of peace, prosperity, commerce, trade, and international cooperation rather than, you know, a terrorist group, that they think that it could be as a tool of their foreign policy vis-a-vis India.
Then there's China. What role can it play? Do you think it could play any role in peace negotiations?
Yes, you know, China can be a major player in peace and prosperity in Afghanistan. China is an important and a strong neighbor of Afghanistan. You know, the whole idea of Belt and Road, which is unfortunately, you know, bypassing Afghanistan, but it's going south in Pakistan, it's going north in Central Asia, and there are links to be built within this Belt and Road, can help Afghanistan economically in future. But right now, security-wise, China is involved both in Moscow format, but also in QCG, which is the Quadrilateral Coordination Group of China, Pakistan, United States, and Afghanistan. So they are interested, they have their ways, and I think they have taken it very serious at the foreign ministry level that the issue of terrorism in Afghanistan need to be finished.
And then there is the topic of Afghan army. So it's spread across the country with Taliban still making gains, capturing villages, capturing military bases. Does the Afghan military have much staying in power left? And I can't answer that question. You can kill me, but I can't answer it. Why is it still on a defensive after 17 years of so much investment and being trained by the world's best soldiers?
You see, on one hand, it's you describe the situation. I think that's close to reality, that we have been spread around the country. We are, you know, fighting in each and every corner of Afghanistan. But the second part is, I think I can give a little bit more explanation on the other side of it. You know, the armies are built, trained, fed, again trained, and then sent to some wars, some part of it. But ours is not like this. They are just recruited, trained a little bit, and then they start fighting. So you don't have the space of, you know, sort of recuperating, going back to some sort of trainings, or changing from one place to another. So It's a way that that you say that, you know, you walk and you chew gum. So that's what, you know, what army is doing. And because that happened toward the end, you know, when I was talking about the surge in military forces in Afghanistan in 2009, it was the time also there was a surge in building the Afghan army. Because at the beginning, there was like 28,000, 30,000, 15,000. Afghanistan doesn't need an army, it needs only police. I think these were the ideas of international community and our friends, our donors, which were wrong from the very beginning. We told them that, look, you know, this is a mountainous country. It has valleys. It's so difficult to control them. It's not, you know, small open plains that you can control it. So, and it also has porous borders. The terrorists could go to the other side of the border and then they come back. So the decision to increase the Afghan army up to the level 350 plus thousand that we have right now, it was after 2010. So if you look at this, and then we're also pushed that, look, train your army quickly because we are getting out. So this army is doing the job of 120,000 well-trained international forces, including NATO. So, and the cost of those people, like, you know, per person would have been something like $1 million. If you compare it to what we have, this is, you know, peanuts. It's very meager. So, yes, we have difficulty. We have been in defensive a little bit in the past because President, you know, we decided that let's show, you know, a gesture for peace, not you know, being offensive. So we told the Taliban that, look, you know, we respect ceasefire, which they did at the beginning, but they didn't do. But recently, the president and the defense minister and National Security Council has ordered we are on full offense. But we need to look at the strategy. That do we need to really, you know, fight in each like an insurgent, a guerrilla force? Because we are facing a force which can vanish inside, you know, villages.
Sometimes I'm thinking Taliban doesn't even want to win the war because it's so much more comfortable as a position to be seen as guerrillas and fighters for motherland than to actually run the country. It's more comfortable, no?
I mean, that's a way of looking at it. Some other people told me the same thing. They, you know, why Taliban want to come? Win is, of course, something we don't believe that Taliban can win the way that they defined win in 1996 and they come with their pickups inside the Kabul. That's not the way that win will be defined. But you know, an insurgent group will always have cohesion, will always be romanticized when they are in the jungles and the mountains and in the villages, because they are not as responsible as a government should be. You know, they can enforce their will through violence. But, you know, the minute they came in, of course, they will lose and they will be difficult for them. But I think there are elements that they think that the war has been for long enough and there's nothing left in their life. They have not seen, you know, a day of, you know, light of the day with peace and
stability. Like half of your country, they've been born after the war.
Exactly.
The last version of war has started.
I think there is that hope for us that it's a generational change which is happening in the country, and the new generation probably needs a new approach.
But that generation doesn't know a life without a war. From day one that they were born 17 years ago, the only thing they know is war. They don't even know another way of life can exist.
No, but I think that is... If you look at Afghanistan of before 2001, I think that would have been correct true characterization of what happens, because that time it was as isolated, you know, as it could be for any country, like, you know, probably maybe isolated African country, but that's not the case right now. Even the people who are living or who are in the areas which are contested by Taliban, they have access to this, you know, today's world. They have access to their technology, they have access to internet, they have access to this, what's happening in the cities. I think they want something new for them. But one thing that you're right is that, you know, that's why we try, we know peace is costly, to inculcate the culture of peace. Because if you are grown with a culture of war, then the war is the way of life. So I think that is a social difficulty that we are facing. But that's why, you know, we're trying to reach peace. That's why we're trying ceasefires. So for those fighters who were just born in 2001 or 2002 and now they are 17, 18 years old, to come into the big cities and to see what life has changed for the Afghan people. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of young Afghans, including the girls, which have trained themselves and they have come up to a level that they can match anyone around the region. So I think that disparity is there between the rural and urban areas, but we wanted to reduce this disparity, these gaps, and let the local people in the villages who are associated to some extent with Taliban to come and see that the life has changed and they can be part of this changed Afghanistan.
Some of the Afghan officials that I have spoken in the past have said that, well, I've asked, how can Taliban, in essence, win a war of rifles against modern technology? Because that's what it is. It's like, because Taliban are more connected to people than the Afghan military at this point. And we need more foreign forces to help us fight Taliban. Do you feel that's the case? Would you need more NATO forces, for example, to help you fight Taliban? Do you want Trump to reinforce its presence in Afghanistan? What do you expect of Trump?
You see, I don't think, you know, we need to go back to invite more foreign forces. I think that's our position, and that's also the position of the government, that we should do it ourselves. Because in any case, even if there is a number of contingents, they have to go back one day to their countries. So on that, I think there is a no. But yes, to stay with us, to help Afghanistan overcome these difficulties, and to help this generational change to happen. Because these changes in countries in conflicts like Afghanistan has to be generational, in the sense that, you know, the generation of after 2001, like, for example, you know, my sisters, they went to school after 2001, and now she is in the fourth year of medicine. So she needs a little bit more time to be empowered completely. And the same thing happens to, you know, many other boys and the girls. So, and in any insurgency, in any conflict like this, if the governments are supported and they have the staying power, it's the insurgents that ultimately will decide that, look, you know, we can be in the mountains, we can be in the jungles for, you know, for decades, the same like happened to FARC. You know, their fighting started even in 1950s, ours is in 1980. So, but ultimately, they find out that in Bogota, there will be elections, there will be, you know, restaurants, the people are going, coming. Yes, you can explode bombs, but people will continue with the way of life, and ultimately you have to come and join. Our history has been difficult in the past because it was insurgent every time which has come to Kabul. So I think we want to change this, and that change will happen with the, you know, with the belief in our partners, if it is United States, if it is, you know, Russia, if it's India, Iran, Pakistan, Turkey, whoever, that let's keep supporting this, you know, with whatever they can, so we can have elections, you know, we can have life the way it happens. Otherwise, if it falls, if the state collapses, I think then you have to start from the very beginning, which is not good for anyone.
Deputy Foreign Minister Randhir, thank you for this interview and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.